Okay, you are, oh yes, Mr. Page.
Good morning. May it please the court? If an alien were extradited to the United States after his deportation, I submit the Constitution would not permit a prosecution for illegal reentry based on that extradition. Even if the extradition were lawful, and even if he were guilty of the offense that caused him to be extradited back to the United States, not because his return was not his fault, but because it wasn't his act. And our Constitution doesn't permit the government to prosecute people for acts it requires of them and that it compels them to undertake. Neither should the Constitution permit the government to punish the defendant's involuntary presence in a jail as the continuation of a criminal offense.
Well, it's not really involuntary if you're drunk driving with a child. I mean, I don't call it involuntary.
Well, the presence in the jail was involuntary. I agree that the criminal act was voluntary, but that's not what's being punished. What 4A1.1D punishes is the commission of the instant offense while under a criminal justice sentence, not the act that causes the defendant to remain inside the United States. An analogy in this,
which he had to do.
I'm sorry?
He didn't have to come back, and he certainly didn't have to drive drunk with a child and thereby get arrested. I just think, I don't consider this a status crime that you've argued. Maybe you could address that.
Well, the act of reentering the United States is not a status crime, and the act of drunk driving is not a status crime. But that's not what the adjustment punishes. What the words of the adjustment are, add 2 points if the defendant commits the instant offense while under a criminal justice sentence. Committing the instant offense isn't drunk driving, and it is reentering the United States, but that's not, he didn't do that under a criminal justice sentence. What he did under a criminal justice sentence was sit in a jail. And that's something that was required of him.
What precisely is the government criminalizing here that you say is prohibited?
It's the continuation of the offense by remaining in a jail, by being present in the United States.
Well, put him in jail kept him from leaving, but the government didn't tell him to be present, did it? Did it compel his presence in the United States?
He just
couldn't get out. He couldn't get out of Dodge quick enough because the government caught him.
That's right. And
I'm trying to get precisely the connection. I understand your argument. It's well stated. But my question is, I don't quite get the connection between saying that they're not prosecuting him because he didn't leave. He'd still be guilty of the offense. They wouldn't count him. Correct?
Right. I think the question is,
what the government did by detaining him was not to cause him to commit the act, but was simply it prevented him from escaping a consummated criminal act.
It's not that it prevented him from escaping it. It's that it caused him to continue it. And so the question is that Robinson establishes that there are constitutional limits under the Eighth Amendment under what...
That goes back to what... When was the criminal... did he violate the statute? When he came back in?
He violated it when he came back in, and then he continued it while he was in a state jail.
It was a continuing offense. But he had committed the criminal offense when he came back in.
He had committed a criminal offense when he came in, and what's being punished here is the continuation of that offense while he's in a jail. So the question is, Robinson establishes that there are constitutional limits under what may be made criminal. Does it establish constitutional limits on what may be described as the continuation of a criminal offense? And the reason that it should impose those same limits is that the government's statements about what constitutes a continuation of a criminal offense, no less than its statements about when a criminal offense begins, tell the people subject to its law what's expected of them. It tells them what's criminal and what's stigmatized. And what is being punished here and what is being described as criminal is the defendant's bare presence in a jail. It is true that if the...
Well, that sort of says like he's got a constitutional... You can't criminalize him being present if you didn't have a fair opportunity to leave. So if the government hemmed up a bunch of illegal aliens in a canyon down in South Texas and they stayed up there for 6 weeks and couldn't get out, they have a constitutional right to say, you can't charge me with this crime because I couldn't leave.
Well, but the...
And you detained me. And what's the difference?
The difference is that it is the part of the offense that and only the part of the offense that occurred in a jail which is being criminal, which is being punished as criminal and described as criminal here. It is.
Oh yeah, that's right. Now what?
So it's only the part of the offense that is in the jail which is described as criminal. So we have to look at precisely that piece of the offense in order to determine whether or not it may be described as criminal.
Suppose instead of charging him with manslaughter, they had indicted him here and never charged him.
I'm sorry?
Suppose instead of prosecuting for the manslaughter, they had, for whatever reason, they didn't do that. They simply, because the defense proceeded on him and the state prosecutor said, well, you can have him. So they never, in fact, put him in jail.
Could they
maintain this prosecution?
Well, it could maintain the prosecution. He wouldn't get criminal history points.
I'm sorry?
He wouldn't get criminal history points for continuing the offense while he was under a criminal justice sentence.
Well, you're talking about now, you're quarreling not with a conviction, you're quarreling with the fact that you say he gets increased punishment?
Correct. I'm saying that he shouldn't get increased punishment for continuing the offense while it's in a jail. It is a sentencing challenge. In that sense, it is the increment of the punishment which is attributable to his presence in a jail, which is under a constitutional attack here. And I think that your hypothetical, Judge Higginbotham, tends to show what is irrational about the punishment here and why it is irrational to punish involuntary acts. If the state authorities had called the federal government before the sentence were imposed, he wouldn't have to criminal history points, because he would have served all of his time in a state jail after his offense of being in the United States illegally before being found had been completed, which demonstrates that there is a portion of the sentence attributable to the accident of when state authorities happened to call the federal government. What penological purpose is served by that distinction between defendants where the state notifies the federal government before and after their sentencing date? They're convicted of identical offenses. They receive identical sentences from a state authority, and yet because one of them commits an involuntary portion of his offense before the state notifies the federal authority, he receives an increase in punishment. There's no value in terms of deterrence or incapacitation.
It's not involuntary. You keep pretending this is some innocent event. The man reappeared in the country voluntarily. Then he got arrested for voluntarily committing a crime. So, of course, he's in the prison being held. I mean, have you ever heard of a case like this where you've argued this successfully or where anyone else has?
I have not seen constitutional challenges to 4A1.1D. What I would suggest to you is that it matters what the state is punishing and what the government says that it is punishing. If we take an analogy to Robinson, there was evidence in Robinson that the defendant used drugs and that his addiction, the fact that he was addicted to heroin, was a consequence of his use of heroin. And yet the court didn't say 90 days in prison is acceptable for the use of heroin, and so therefore this isn't cruel and unusual punishment. It looked at what is being punished. And in Robinson it said what is being punished is the status of being an addict, not the use of drugs. Similarly here, the defendant has done things to bring this consequence upon himself. There's no doubt about that. And 96 months by itself is not a cruel and unusual punishment. But what is cruel and unusual is to say we are giving you a higher amount of punishment because of the part of the offense that occurred under a criminal justice sentence. For every other offense that this adjustment is applied to, the defendant has a choice about whether or not to commit the offense while under a criminal justice sentence. And here, the part of the offense that occurs under a criminal justice sentence is not undertaken by his choice. The government would like to say that what this really is not a punishment for committing the offense while in a jail, but rather for committing a new DWI offense. But there are a lot of, other than the fact that the guideline doesn't, the guideline tells you what it's punishing committing the instant offense, not the DWI offense, in a state jail. There are also other compelling indications that the government's substituted rationale for that part of the offense is actually not what the adjustment is intending to punish. If the defendant, there are occasions where the defendant can commit a new offense after the reentry and not receive these points, as where the state authorities tell the federal government that he's here before they sentence him. There are occasions when a defendant cannot commit a new offense after he reenters the United States, and he still will receive those points. For instance, if he committed an offense before he were deported, and then they just didn't have the evidence together until he came back, and then he got a new sentence, then the portion of the offense that occurred while he was in a state jail would still get him those points, even though he had committed no new offense after he reentered. And if we are trying to punish the DWI, the question becomes, why isn't the guidelines addition of two criminal history of criminal history points for the DWI itself sufficient to capture that added risk to the public and added recidivism? The conclusion from all of that is that the guideline is punishing precisely what it says it's punishing, which is the defendant's presence in a jail, the commission of the instant offense in a jail. And so long as we are to have Robinson, we can't describe involuntary conduct or conduct that the government requires of the defendant as a criminal offense. If that's all, I have nothing further.
Thank you. Mr. McKay.
May it please the court, counsel, Brian McKay on behalf of the United States. In an effort to thread a very narrow needle, Mr. Flores is inviting the court to view this as a case in which a sentencing guideline criminalized the fact that he was in prison. But as the court has pointed out, that's not what happened here. Instead, Mr. Flores, after reentering the country illegally and while choosing to remain in the country illegally, also chose to commit a new offense. And because of that, he was under a criminal sentence when immigration authorities found him. Now, the advisory guidelines range that were applied took that into consideration. And that guideline range, which no one disputes was calculated in compliance with this court's authority, and that guideline range, which is presumed to yield a sentence that is reasonable on appeal, that guidelines range was increased by about 9 months. And I submit that there's nothing cruel, nothing unusual, and nothing unfair about that. Now, in the time I have with the court this morning, I hope to make 3 points in addition to answering any questions the court may have. First, that Mr. Flores' claim does not fit within Robinson or any other Eighth Amendment claim that's been recognized by the Supreme Court. The second, that the success of Mr. Flores' argument depends entirely upon this court stepping away from or reversing course from more than 15 years of established authority that holds that illegal reentry is a continuing offense that began when Mr. Flores entered the country illegally and continued until he was found by immigration authorities.
And does it continue while he's incarcerated?
It does. And there's no reason to reconsider Santana on that point. And the third point, because opposing counsel suggests that Santana promotes some sort of manipulation by government authorities, I want to address that argument and show that it doesn't hold water. In Ingram versus Wright, the Supreme Court recognized that there are three manners in which the Eighth Amendment Cruel and Unusual Punishments Clause limits the criminal process. First, by limiting the types of sentences that can be imposed.
But the guidelines that we're talking about here, are they advisory or mandatory?
They are advisory, and that is an important point, Judge Higginbotham. And I think, among other things, it points out that the guideline does not criminalize any conduct, despite how Mr. Flores might characterize it in his brief. And in Robinson, skipping to the third limitation, the one that's most relevant here, Mr. Flores is attempting to...
The argument is that it violates the Eighth Amendment to allow a district judge to take into consideration the fact of incarceration.
That's correct. His argument in trying to fit it into Robinson, he's characterizing it as the guidelines, the increased punishment for an admittedly illegal act was cruel or unusual. And in Robinson, it wasn't just that someone's status as an addict led to increased punishment. It was the fact that someone's status, in fact, was criminal. And here, we don't have any dispute that there was a criminal act, the act of illegal reentry. What we're talking about is whether it is appropriate to take that into consideration when assessing a sentence. And
well, it is a creative argument, I must say.
It is creative, certainly.
Mr. Page is good at that.
Well,
he is.
Good at
I wouldn't
that.
Encourage it.
No.
But he's good at it.
But what it isn't Robinson. It simply doesn't fit here. Now, out of abundance of caution, the government in its brief did perceive Mr. Flores as challenging the proportionality, and I think the government in its 28J letter addressing Cardenas-Alvarez, I think squarely put that to rest, where an even longer sentence involving less culpable offense behavior was still found to be within constitutionality.
Let me ask you something. The found in part of this criminal statute is there to deal with a situation where he entered 10 years ago or a long time ago and wasn't found until much later. Does that deal with a statute of limitations problem, or what is that designed to do?
Certainly. One of the effects is that it deals with a statute of limitations problem. If the act was solely the illegal act was solely crossing into the country illegally, then as long as they were able to remain undetected.
No adverse possession.
Precisely. There's no adverse possession to being in the country legally. Now, turning to his due process claim, that claim depends entirely upon this court reconsidering and stepping away from Flores-Santana, Castellano. There's simply no reason to do that in this case. Contrary to Mr. Flores' brief, there simply is no tension between Santana and any subsequent authority decisions of this court. He points to Brazell as being in tension. I would think that would be surprising, considering that the court in Brazell explicitly relied on Santana, and so it would be odd if in doing that, the court created tension between the two. In fact, Brazell was looking at willfulness being a part of the underlying offense, there the criminal nonpayment of child support. And the court determined that that offense ceased to exist when the willfulness evaporated. But in doing that, the court didn't apply a blanket rule, certainly one not that it intended to apply in illegal reentry cases, that once someone is held in the country against their will, as Mr. Flores would portray it, ceases to be eligible for the two-point criminal history points under 4A1.1D. Santana is not in conflict with any other circuits. In fact, it's been adopted by at least three and a couple of others in plain error review cases. And Santana doesn't create any tension or doesn't stand in conflict with any subsequent amendments to the sentencing guidelines. And so there really is no reason here to reconsider or step away from more than 15 years of established authority. Now, turning to the argument that somehow the application of Santana encourages government actors to manipulate when an illegal alien is found in the jail simply doesn't hold water for a few reasons. I can think of three. First, as Judge Higginbotham pointed out, we are talking about an advisory guidelines regime. Now, I haven't seen in the 15 years since Santana, I've not seen a case in which there was evidence of that type of manipulation or gamesmanship. And I've not seen it in cases I've dealt with, cases that have never come to this court. But suppose that there was evidence of that. If a defendant believed that that was the case, I would suppose that a district judge would want to hear that evidence, and if persuaded that that type of gamesmanship occurred, that's probably something that the district judge would take into consideration when determining whether to impose a guideline sentence or whether there's reason to vary from the guidelines and impose a non-guideline sentence. And as a practical matter, I would submit that that type of manipulation of when an alien is found is probably, in all practicality, going to backfire. Because if local officials hold off purposefully notifying INS while an alien is in pretrial detention, that's likely going to backfire in that we know that pretrial detention can end rather abruptly, either because someone makes bail, because charges are dismissed, or someone's acquitted. And if local authorities have delayed or immigration authorities have purposefully delayed in finding that alien, then he's on the street and may never be found at all.
Why would they delay just to get the funding from the feds?
I'm sorry?
Why would the state or the county delay turning him over to get the lodging expense?
I think Mr. Flores's argument would be that they purposefully delayed so that this two-point criminal history.
But in the real world.
But in the real world, I don't know that they would.
Some counties have contracts and generate a lot of revenue to warehouse prisoners, so they are happy to have them stay there.
Which would I would suppose
just a question being incarcerated someplace else.
Which I would suppose would cut against Mr. Flores' argument and actually incentivize the county to notify ICE as soon as possible. And the third reason that argument doesn't hold water is because it completely ignores that Mr. Flores and people in similar circumstances do have control over the continuation of their offense. He stresses the fact that he remained in jail and couldn't leave the country voluntarily, but he does exercise control over whether he continues to commit the offense of remaining in the country undetected. If someone in Mr. Flores' circumstance is truly worried about the application of 4A1.1D, nothing prevents him from terminating his offense by inviting immigration officials to find him. And he can do that during the pretrial period if he chooses to do that. Now, as a practical matter, he may not do that, but nothing prevents him from either through counsel in person if he's on bail or by letter notifying immigration authorities of his illegal presence in the country and prompting them.
After deportation?
He may do that. And there are certainly...
At this point, he's been charged with a crime.
He's being held in pretrial detention on a crime. And savvy defense counsel may also see other reasons, not just avoiding 4A1.1D, but Mr. Page alluded to these circumstances, it might be that by pointing out that the defendant is going to be deported, in certain cases, the state authorities may determine that it's not worth their time and effort to pursue charges and may dismiss charges because he is going to be deported. And those 2 points never apply. But as worried as he may be that such gamesmanship is going to happen on the part of the government, and as I explained, that's unlikely to happen, a defendant in his position still remains in control of when he is found. But most, as a practical matter, wish to remain unfound even while they're incarcerated under a criminal sentence. Now, by its operation in illegal reentry cases, Section 4A1.1D recommends that offenders receive a marginally longer sentence because they're convicted of new crimes while they are in the country illegally. And there's nothing unfair and certainly nothing unconstitutional about that. Instead, it is a perfectly reasonable sentencing strategy or practice. And for that reason, the government would request that the court affirm. And unless there are any other questions, I'll cede the rest of my time.
Thank you. Mr. Page?
May it please the court? I submit that the argument that's before the court is no more creative than the idea of an offense continuing merely by breathing in a jail cell. It is true that Robinson is a case about criminal liability rather than sentencing, and that this particular challenge doesn't fit neatly into any of the categories of Eighth Amendment challenges that have been recognized. But before Graham versus Florida, for instance, there were no categorical challenges to a term of years. And Graham emphasized that the Eighth Amendment must be interpreted flexibly and dynamically in order to effectuate the ends that it is intended to meet. I don't think that the court is required to step away from 15 years of precedent. Santana Castellano and the cases that Reyes Nava and the cases that cite those cite them.
Let me ask you a question, though. First, I should tell you that creative is not a pejorative term.
No.
So, but suppose you had this individual exactly in the same situation, except that instead of committing a crime, he became seriously ill, and the family took him to the emergency room, the hospital, and he required 2 months of intensive treatment, and he could not leave physically, and the doctor said he would die.
Yes.
Now, how would the law treat that situation?
That would be a much closer case than this, because at least in that case, you wouldn't have somebody who is continuing their presence because of what the government is making them do. You would have somebody that is continuing their presence by chance or by happenstance. And so in that circumstance, at least you don't have the perverse situation of the government punishing its own punishment. I think I would submit under those circumstances, Robinson might call for that not to be a basis of increased punishment. But that's a much closer case than this one.
Unless the person knew they were suffering from cancer and came here for the treatment, then you've got the voluntary aspect similar to yours.
You would, but because you have something that is the criminal act of entering the country was so closely linked to the status of being here in that circumstance. And I don't think you can say here that the criminal act of entering the country is related to his presence in a state jail when there's this intervening cause of the government keeping here by what it requires. It is true that the guidelines are advisory, but they are presumed to be the reasoning of a court that enacts a guideline sentence unless the court says otherwise. And, for instance, the failure to explain cases, the court has said, well, if it's a guideline sentence, we can presume that the 3553A analysis that goes into the making the guidelines is the reasoning of the sentencing court. And here, the sentencing court had an opportunity to disavow the constitutional problem in the guidelines, these 2 points analysis, and declined to do so. It simply overruled the constitutional objection. Finally, I want to just to clarify, my argument is not that the government would ever manipulate the. When the federal government is notified in order to give the defendant guideline points. I wouldn't attribute that to the government, and I don't think that's likely. The point that I'm trying to make is that those two defendants, one who is state notifies the feds before and one where the state notifies the feds after, have committed basically identical conduct, and that it is arbitrary to give one more punishment than to give the other one simply because of the accident of when the state authorities happened to call the federal government. If there are no further questions,
thank you
very much.